Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Your reader for Tech Talk will be Paul Henkel, and our articles will come from the New York Times Technology section. Article number one. Telecommuting has changed real estate. As more people are able to work from home, housing priorities have changed, and different places and types of housing have become more popular. As wireless technology changes how and where people do their jobs, giving many the freedom to work remotely at least part of the time, so too is it changing their thinking about real estate. Remote workers still represent a minority of the workforce. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, as of last year, about 24% of employed persons worked at least part of the time at home. Among those with advanced degrees, it was 42%. In a survey last year of 23,000 new home shoppers, John Burns Real Estate Consulting, a firm with offices across the country, found that roughly 30% worked at home between 1 and 4 days a week, 13% worked at home full-time. Nevertheless, as the numbers have grown, some in the real estate industry are wondering about the long-term impact, said Zach Ahrens, a co-founder of Metaprop, a New York City ventures capital firm focused on real estate technology. Some investors in New York real estate see a potential threat if remote workers start to exit the city for less expensive locations, he said. The looming question is, do people live in the city because they like the community or just because it's convenient to their job? Brad Hargreaves, the founder and chief executive of Common, which operates co-living communities in urban markets, said that while he believed the trend away from daily in-office work would continue, he didn't believe it would result in an exodus out of major cities. I still think there's a lot of benefit for people living in an urban center, both personally and professionally, he said. What will be needed is more flexibility for residential spaces. The rise in remote work is already changing people's preferences in single-family home and apartment design and affording them greater freedom in choosing where and how to live. Here are 7 ways in which the trend is changing the housing market. Office space. The importance of home offices has almost begun to rival the attention that buyers give to kitchens, said Robin Kensel, an associate broker with Compass in Greenwich, Connecticut. Where they will work is on nearly every buyer's mind. While some buyers just want a comfortable space to plop down with their laptops, others want a dedicated room where they can shut the door and take calls without interruption. Back in the day, you'd have the mahogany-paneled library, but we're not living in a formal world now, Ms. Kensel said. Now people are looking for more of a textured, comfortable feeling, natural light, doors to a private terrace, and great wall and floor finishes. Allison Bernstein, the president of Suburban Jungle Real Estate Agency, based in New York City, also finds that buyers are highly focused on how do we functionally work at home. And that focus extends to workspace for their children. Dedicated homework areas are very, very popular, Ms. Bernstein said. Media rooms are so yesterday. Now that people can stream whatever they want to watch on their smartphones, laptops, or tablets anywhere in the house, spaces designed solely for that purpose are increasingly viewed as superfluous, Ms. Bernstein said. New home sizes are trending downward, and buyers are looking for spaces that can serve more than one purpose, said Robert Dietz, the chief economist for the National Association of Home Builders. Dedicating space for a media room has fallen out of favor, he said. The shift also ties in with the rise in remote work. People who spend a lot of time working at home frequently don't want to spend most of their leisure hours there as well. Especially in the city, said Martin Iden, an associate broker with Compass in New York. They are usually dying to go out and meet people, he said. The home entertainment factor has gone down. A shift in apartment design. Lounge spaces set up as shared work areas for residents are common now in newer residential towers in New York, But developers are also tweaking apartment layouts to make it easier for residents to set up a home office. At Evora, a new 184-unit condominium on the Hudson River in Weehawken, New Jersey, buyers can choose from floor plans that include an alcove bonus space. The spaces, which measure 11 feet square, provide a dedicated space for work at home, but they've also been used as an art studio for a child or a place to display an art collection, said Jill Preschel, the vice president of sales and marketing for the New York Metro Division of Lancy Homes, the California-based developer. At Rose Hill, a new 45-story luxury condominium tower in the Nomad neighborhood of Manhattan, about half of the 123 units come with small flex rooms that can be closed off with sliding glass doors. The designs provide buyers with the extra workspace they may need without requiring them to pay for an additional bedroom, said Meg Broad, a senior vice president and a regional development officer for the Rockefeller Group. You're only paying for what you need, but it's extra room you can really appreciate, she said. The rise of co-living. Co-living developments now account for more than 3,000 beds in cities across the country, with at least another 9,000 in the pipeline, according to a recent report from Cushman and Wakefield. The communities offer tenants private bedrooms in suites with shared living areas, generally more affordable than standard rentals and with more flexible lease terms. The developments also offer shared common areas for socializing and working. The trend toward co-living is very closely correlated with the rise in remote work. It's that desire for flexibility and to be able to move from job to job, city to city, without there being huge ramifications in getting out of leases, said Susan Jerkson, a managing director at Cushman. Common operates about 30 co-living developments in six cities, including about 20 in New York. Mr. Hargreaves said a double-digit percentage of the company's tenants work remotely. Tenants can transfer within the common network at any time, which is a perk for independent contractors. If they're working in New York, but they get a gig in San Francisco or Chicago, members can transfer without breaking their lease, Mr. Hargreaves said. Lower mobility rates. Americans are moving less often. The average household moves every 9 years compared to every 6 years in the 1980s, according to data provided by John Burns Real Estate Consulting. That's primarily because of an aging population. You've got more people who've moved up there to their final house on the ladder, said Mr. Dietz of the National Association of Home Builders. On top of that, he said, many people who bought or refinanced their mortgages when interest rates reach historic lows have chosen not to move and risk paying a higher rate. But Rick Palacios, Jr., the director of research at John Burns, theorizes that the falling mobility rate may also be connected to the increase in telecommuting. If you work at home, you don't necessarily have to move if your job moves, he said. And many companies, ours included, view e-commuting as a competitive advantage that allows us to attract the best and the brightest, regardless of geography. Some suburbs are better for remote workers. Ms. Bernstein of Suburban Jungle said almost all her clients have the ability to work at home at least one day a week. But when choosing a town to live in, they emphasize that they don't want to feel isolated. They want coffee shops and cafes with free Wi-Fi, co-working spaces, places to find community, she said, and some towns are developing real personalities for that. Her short list of places where remote workers in the New York region are congregating in greater numbers includes Montclair, New Jersey, Pleasantville and White Plains, New York, and Greenwich and Westport, Connecticut. Moving away from major job centers. New Yorkers make up the largest share of new residents to Florida in 2017 at almost 64,000 people compared with 53,000 in 2012, according to census data. Changes in federal tax laws that sharply limit deductions for state and local income taxes created new incentives for New Yorkers to move to the lower-tax Sunshine State, and people who can work remotely are feeling especially free to do so, said J. Philip Parker, chief executive of Douglas Eileman's Florida brokerage. There are people that might have delayed their relocation to Florida, but because they can work remotely, it's enhanced their ability to move sooner, he said. And it's easy for them to fly in and out of New York City. There seems to be so many people hopping back and forth. Derek Buxban, a co-owner of Remax Shoreline in Portland, Maine, said the housing market there had been tremendously impacted by remote work, with more buyers coming in from Boston and New York. Telecommuters can easily get to meetings in either city without driving. Amtrak trains travel direct to Boston, and Concord coach lines run two buses daily to Manhattan. In Vermont, a program that offers to cover up to $10,000 in moving and some other expenses for remote workers who relocate to the state is luring urban refugees from all over. Since January, the state has approved 56 applicants to the program, nine of whom were from the New York metropolitan area, according to Nate Formulari, the Director of Communications for the state's Agency of Commerce and Community Development. The other applicants were primarily from other major city centers, including Chicago, Denver, Los Angeles, and Boston. Most are in their 30s and are bringing a spouse and or kids with them, Mr. Formulari said. Altogether, we've got about 140 new residents. Now in article number 2, Uber and Lyft drivers gain labor clout with help from an app. When California lawmakers passed a worker protection bill essentially requiring Uber and Lyft to treat drivers as employees, it was thanks in part to a little-known group called Rideshare Drivers United. Uber and Lyft had hoped for a deal with organized labor, exempting them from the measure, and the Teamsters and the Service Employees International Union explored such an agreement. But Rideshare Drivers United, which represents more than 5,000 drivers in Southern California, fought the idea, speaking out for members who viewed it as a betrayal. From the beginning, they've been the voice of rideshare drivers not just in California, but nationwide, Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, the bill's author, said of Rideshare Drivers United. Any union that wants to be the voice of rideshare drivers has to be inclusive of that group and others. Rideshare Drivers United is not a household name within the labor movement or even a legally recognized union, and it represents only a fraction of drivers in California, but its growing clout challenges the notion that highly dispersed workers are nearly impossible to organize absent a deal with their employer or the state, which can come with strings attached. While frustrated drivers have often formed loose associations using Facebook, or even homebrew technology, Rideshare Drivers United appears to have outpaced its predecessors by deploying an app that enables organizers to contact drivers as seamlessly as if they shared a water cooler. The way to organize a workforce that doesn't come to an office, said Deborah Cleaver, an organizer and the founder of a digital voter registration service, Vote.org, is to make it easy for people to be engaged. The drivers group is now moving to use this technology in a further challenge to the ride-hailing companies' grip on the labor relationship, and its efforts could serve as a model in other industries like fast work, fast food, or domestic work. Rideshare Drivers United began to take its current form in 2017 when Ivan Pardo, a software developer, and Nicole Moore, a part-time Lyft driver and former union organizer, joined a predecessor group a few months apart. Mr. Pardo and Ms. Moore created a committee whose mission was to talk to drivers about their problems on the job. But while traditional organizers can approach workers in a break room or a company parking lot, Rideshare Drivers United needed a different way to connect. That's where Mr. Pardo's skills came in. Uber and Lyft drivers typically find the group's website through Facebook and are prompted to provide information like their location and, later, their availability for a 10 to 15 minute call. Mr. Pardo's software then queues up a list of new members who will be available when an organizer has time to make calls, significantly increasing their chances of connecting. After the call, the organizer places the new member into one of four categories, from disengaged, sharing some of the group's frustrations but unlikely to take action, to a potential core, a prospective leader. The organizer who conducts the call becomes the new member's dedicated contact, fielding future texts and calls. "That is our workplace," Ms. Moore said. "It's how we talk to each other." The information gathered helps with communications. For example, in planning a trip to Sacramento to push for the labor bill, the group placed unsolicited calls only to drivers from the top two categories of engagement, figuring that such calls to others would have been wasted effort. Ms. Moore and Mr. Pardo tested their approach in January after learning of Governor Gavin Newsom's intention to press the ride-hailing companies and unions to negotiate a compromise on the labor bill. Dozens of people turned out in front of a Los Angeles building that housed the governor's office. 2 months later, the group held a protest in which hundreds of people gathered outside an Uber driver's support hub near Los Angeles to complain of low pay. "After that, we had driver groups that were nascent all over the country reaching out to us," Mr. Pardo said. Rideshare Drivers United also helped put together a global strike by Uber drivers in May, 2 days before Uber's initial public offering, over pay and a lack of worker protections. On a Wednesday in late August, two Rideshare Drivers United organizers, Luis Vasquez and Tyler Sandness, sat at desks in the basement of a union building making calls to fellow drivers using Mr. Pardo's software. Mr. Vasquez, who primarily spoke to Spanish-speaking drivers, estimated that one of every three calls yielded pledges to become actively involved. "Especially in the Latino community, people are getting sick of it," Mr. Vasquez said, "of the drivers' wages and working conditions. They're like, no, we've got to do something. We're tired of this. We're not making money, no more, and have to pay all the expenses." A study last year by the Liberal Economic Policy Institute found that Uber drivers made under $11 an hour on average nationally after vehicle expenses and the extra taxes paid by the self-employed were deducted. In addition to a geographically diffuse workforce, high turnover among drivers makes organizing a challenge. But the need of gig workers arising from their lack of benefits and protections can also be a unifying force, experts said. "The gig workforce is really powerful," said Eve Epstein, a labor lawyer who is building an app called Soul Venture to help gig workers band together when buying insurance plans. "We want to harness that power." The Rideshare Drivers United technology can also survey drivers about their priorities. On the California labor bill, which Mr. Newsom signed into law on Wednesday, this helped the group determine that members favored the protections that come with being an employee. Mr. Pardo hopes to license the software to labor groups and nonprofits to support his work for Rideshare Drivers United, which has so far received only small contributions from other labor groups and collects dues from its organizing committee. After the legislative campaign, the group is putting its tools to use in another campaign, helping drivers gain leverage in any future legal fight with Lyft. In late August, Lyft updated the terms of service for riders and drivers, which included a mandatory arbitration clause. This was a long-planned update to the terms to account for new things like bikes and scooters, a Lyft spokesman said. The arbitration clause, a long-standing feature of Lyft's and Uber's terms, bars drivers from joining class action cases against the companies for, say, denying them employee status and the protections that go with it, like a minimum wage, unemployment insurance, and workers' compensation. The law in California appears to entitle drivers to those protections, but court challenges are likely. While Lyft has not commented on how it will respond to the new law, Uber has declared that it will not adjust its policies. The update in terms of service offers drivers a fresh 30-day window to opt out of some or all of the arbitration clause. However, and Mr. Pardo and his colleagues are determined to take advantage. Over the next week, they will send the Lyft drivers in their group a link enabling them to opt out of the agreement by filling out a form and signing their names using their finger or mouse. They will also distribute the link through social media. This is a way that drivers can exercise their rights in a court of law, said Mr. Prado. Lyft is counting on arbitration agreements to keep drivers from getting what belongs to them. Now in article number 3. Tinder created a show to give its users something to hook up about. A Choose Your Own Adventure series is designed to give young Tinder swipers something to talk about. For all of their success, swipe-wide dating apps like Tinder, or Bumble face a problem once their users have matched. It's hard to find things to discuss with total strangers. What are you exactly supposed to say in response to a handshake or a wave? In an effort to solve this, Tinder has created a scripted Choose Your Own Adventure series that it hopes will supply its young users with raw material for conversations on its platform. The goal is to counteract that chronic dating app issue, conversations that die almost as soon as they begin. The project, called Swipe Night, consists of 4 episodes. One will air each week on the Tinder app. In each episode, users who participate will be ushered through an apocalyptic scenario and prompted to make a series of choices, from the seemingly unimportant, how to best DJ a party, to the critical, whose life to save. The show features a cast of young, diverse actors, and like a video game, gives the user a first-person perspective on the action. Participants will then show up in each other's list of potential matches. Some of the choices they made during the show will be visible on their profiles. That is when, the company hopes, a number of those people will swipe right on each other and talk about what they experienced. Last year, Tinder set up a team to survey hundreds of young people. This research helped the company see members of Generation Z as fundamentally different from older generations, and that includes millennials, the oldest of whom are nearly 40. Defining characteristics included Gen Z's immense comfort on social platforms and immense discomfort with defining relationships, or even using words like dating and flirting. Swipe Night also looks to take advantage of their facility with the raw material of pop culture. They speak in GIFs, they react in emojis, they talk in stories, said Eli Seidman, the chief executive of Tinder, of 18 to 25-year-olds who already make up more than 50% of the app's user base. Tinder allows users little space to provide information about themselves on their profiles. That can lead to a particular shortage of subjects to discuss. On Tinder, Mr. Seidman said, approaching strangers is much easier than it is offline. But you get to the next thing, and there's no context, he said. What's the context? Oh, are you also on Tinder? Like, yeah, obviously. Tinder has traditionally been viewed as a pre-date experience. Swipe Night looks to collapse some elements of a first date, the mutual experience of some diversion, into its platform. Episodes of Swipe Night will be available on Tinder on Sundays in October from 6 p.m. to midnight in the user's time zone. For now, the show will be available only to Americans. The choice of day is no accident. Tinder has long seen a surge of user activity on Sundays, but Mr. Seidman said that Swipe Night was not an effort to compete with the traditional entertainment that dominates that night, like Sunday Night Football or HBO's flagship shows. A rough cut of the first episode of Swipe Night was reminiscent of J.J. Abrams' 2008 movie Cloverfield. The show was directed by Karina Evans, 23, best known for directing the Drake music videos Nice for What and In My Feelings. Her experience with music videos, which fuse art marketing as well as her age, made her a natural choice for the Swipe Night project. She came in with a very specific idea of what it looked like, how these characters should talk, what the experience should feel like, what the narrative is, said Paul Bukadakis, the vice president of special initiatives at Tinder. The company declined to say how much Ms. Evans was paid for the project. Variety reported that the Swipe Night production had a budget of more than $5 million. A Tinder spokeswoman said the figure was inaccurate, but would not say whether that meant it was low or high. Mr. Seidman said the project had been a major effort between the creation of the content and production development that had taken the better part of a year. Swipe Night represents a significant gamble for Mr. Seidman, who has run Tinder for 2 years. He has overseen its growth as it has solidified its position as a leader in the dating app category thanks to its thriving subscription business. He said that he did not feel that his head was on the chopping block if Swipe Night were to fail, but there were, of course, some tensions in waiting to see how it turned out. We want it to be great, of course, but we are kind of buoyed by the fact that at the end of it, you get to meet people or talk about what you did, he said. Hopefully what you're talking about is not, oh, this was terrible. In our final article, smart lights enhance home security and shine a light on crime. Smart lighting brightens up your home and makes life more convenient, but it's also an easy and effective way to enhance home security. When it comes to makeshift home security strategies, some people go with a yappy terrier, some choose a battery of fake cameras, and others rely on a generic alarm company badge staked in the front yard. If you prefer to leave the lights on 24/7 technique, or if you rely on old-fashioned timers with fixed schedules, well, we have grim news. You're doing it wrong, as NPR has reported, that can actually attract attention from burglars. Smart lighting, however, turns something as simple and boring as a light bulb into a high-tech perimeter warning, and unlike a guard dog, it doesn't shed. Smart lights outshine non-smart fixes like timers because they're vastly easier to control and they allow you to set them to better mimic the way a home's occupants actually use lights instead of on a predictable schedule. That's Tech Talk for this week. Please join me again next week from the latest from the technology sector.